May it please the court. My name is William Stewart, and I represent plaintiff appellant landowners in an even-numbered section of land that own land in an even-numbered section of land, specifically Lot 2, Section 32, in Township 44 North, Range 7 West, in Bayfield County, Wisconsin. This appeal comes to this court on cross motions for summary judgment.
Well, we didn't have a lot of time. So what's your strongest argument for why Bayfield can't put a snowmobile path through your land?
Your Honor, the strongest argument that we have with respect to Lot 2 is the simple fact that the land was removed from the public domain before Bayfield County, before the railroad that constructed the line, could have possibly achieved any rights under any federal right-of-way act. If you look at the record as it stands right now, the initial settler of Lot 2, whose name is Amos Jefferson, got there first.
But the question that I have is, if you will, what package of rights went to Mr. Jefferson? Your assumption is he got an absolutely perfect fee simple absolute. Actually, in preparing for this case, I was expecting somebody to come in with clods of dirt or something. I haven't thought about land law this much for years. But anyway, the idea that you have is that Mr. Jefferson got every stick in the proverbial bundle of property rights, whereas your opponents look at this 1852 statute, and as did the district court, and said, well, as a matter of fact, no, Mr. Jefferson's plot of land was encumbered by this reversionary interest of the United States in the right-of-way that was designated for the railroad. And so if that encumbrance has always been there, then Mr. Jefferson obviously couldn't have conveyed down the chain to your clients anything more than he had.
No, Your Honor, you are identifying the sort of penultimate issue. And the penultimate issue is who got there first. If at the time...
I don't know that the penultimate issue is who got there first. It's did the 1852 statute operate to reserve this right? It was,
yes.
Your section was, it was all public land, right? Kind of at the
Correct.
Beginning of time. As
yes.
of 1851 and a half, it
Correct.
Was all public land.
Yes. But what happens next, Your Honor, is it's all public land. And you have a set of, you have the 1852 Act, which is a general right-of-way act, which
right.
any railroad could take advantage of. But then you also have the Land Sales Act of 1820, which allows settlers to purchase land under that act. And the question is who removed Lot 2 from the public domain first? That is the question. Now, my opponents say...
You're not putting it clearly. Well, what is the effect of the 1852 Act?
As it relates to Lot 2, Your Honor, there is no effect on under the 1852
well,
Act. Because 1852 could only give the railroad a set of rights upon either the filing of a map of definite location or construction of the line. That is the first and only time that that lot could have been removed from the public domain.
It would have to be that Northern Wisconsin Railroad was not the successor to the St. Croix. Isn't that what you have to argue?
That is one of our arguments, Your Honor, which is whether or not...
the most important as well as the clearest, right? I mean, the argument is that you had to have this... you had to have the railroad chartered by 1867, and North Wisconsin's charter was 1871. And your argument is that North Wisconsin is not the successor to St. Croix. They don't have any corporate relationship of any sort. It was a brand new grant. And it was after the 1852 Act and its extension. Isn't that your whole argument?
That is one of our primary arguments, Your Honor. You're absolutely correct, and you articulated it perfectly.
And can I suggest maybe one other way of looking at it? Because if you look back to the 19th century and you recall that corporation law was not as well developed, to put it mildly, as it is today, The thought that I have is, although under modern corporation law, state legislation provides a certain method of corporate succession, usually through, some kind of transaction, purchase of stock, or maybe even assets or what have you, In this instance, you actually have special legislation, and I'm not sure why the state of Wisconsin couldn't, through its legislature, say that the Second Railroad was the successor to the first through a special act, which appears to be what it did. You know, why doesn't that equivalently make it a successor?
The General Right-of-Way Act of 1852 would have got transferred title specifically from the United States to the railroad, any railroad that actually complied with its terms. Now, there's
no
evidence it complied with the terms.
Interest, right?
No, the statutes that Your Honor is referring to are under the 1856-1864 Acts, which are state-mediated acts. So in that instance, under the 1856-1864 Acts, which are land grants, not right-of-way acts, what would happen is the United States would transfer the interest to the state of Wisconsin, who would then transfer the interest to the railroad. And that was the process under the 1856-1864 and all the statutes that Your Honor is referencing. Under the 1852 Act, Judge, the process was entirely different. The process there was that any railroad who invoked the terms of the Act, as Judge Posner suggested, who could meet the terms of the Act, would receive a direct grant from the United States to the railroad. Here, Your Honor, what's happening is that I'm...
But then the question is, does it pass down to successors to the railroad once it gets the grant?
If there were...
And then if there's an alternative way, if the normal way that we think of succession is a little bit too 20th, 21st century bound, is there a different way that you could be a successor?
Your Honor, for Bayfield County's argument to make any sense, they would have to say that in 1857, the La Crosse and Milwaukee Railroad, who was the first railroad who obtained any sort of rights under the 1856-1864 Act,
right,
that they received rights under the 1852 Act. Then you would have to say that, well, because they didn't actually construct any portion of the Bayfield branch, that at some point it went to the St. Croix Railroad Company in 1857. So that there would have to be a private conveyance from La Crosse to St. Croix.
I'm trying to ask you why the legislation from the state of Wisconsin didn't accomplish the same thing.
Fair question, because it dealt with an entirely different set of issues, Judge.
But you're not making it clear. As I understand it, so St. Croix Railroad, it had the benefit of the 1852 Act, right?
No, Your Honor, I would say that there's no evidence that that's the case.
It
could have.
It
yes.
could have,
yes.
right? It was chartered in time. Okay, it could have. But we're now talking, aren't we, about the statute which says, after Wisconsin acquired the property, there's hereby granted to the North Wisconsin Railway Company, all the rights, title, and interest, et cetera, which state of Wisconsin has. Isn't that the grant? That's what gets Northern Railroad into the picture, right?
Under the 1852 Act, Your Honor? The act was not to the state of Wisconsin, it was to the railroad
the
itself.
Land the land granted to North Wisconsin Railway Company, isn't that what we're talking about?
No, Your Honor. We are talking about the grant to North Wisconsin Railway Company.
Right.
Right.
Now, that grant doesn't say anything about the right-of-ways, does it?
No, it does not, Your Honor. It is specific to the 1856.
St. Croix had right-of-ways. This statute did not transfer them to Wisconsin. Isn't that the essence of your argument?
Yes, Your Honor,
so
that's absolutely correct.
This is. It's not the same thing as St. Croix. It's
entirely different. You're right, Your Honor. And I see that my time is up.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Stewart. I mean, we'll give you more time later if necessary. Ms. Fox?
Good morning. My name is Cecilia Fex. I represent the appellants Imogene Johnson and the Samuel C. Johnson 1988 Trust. May it please the court.
You're on the odd lot side of things?
Yes, I am. There are two issues that I want to cover today. The first is whether Section 912 served to efficiently dispose of federal reversionary interests or to impede their disposition. The second is whether under the 1856 Act, indefeasible fee title transferred from the United States to the state of Wisconsin and then to the railroad in Section 21. Turning first to Section 912.
Taking it in reverse order, the 1856 Act, so far as the odd lots are concerned, odd-numbered lots, that did grant, didn't it say that it was granting them for the purpose of building a railroad?
Yes, it did.
Okay. So that's the source of the government's argument that there's some implicit reversionary interest.
There's an implicit reversionary interest and an implied right of way.
There has to be some merit to that, right? Because otherwise you could have a company that says, you know, we're a railroad, and sure, we'd like to have this land, and so we'll build a railroad. And so they give them, so the government sells the land, fee simple, gives them fee simple, no statement of reversionary interest. But then this is really a fake, and the buyer decides not going to build a railroad, just wants the land. Now, wouldn't the government have a right to take that back?
If the railroad did not actually construct a right-of-way, then there was a forfeiture provision which provided that the lands could be forfeited so long as the United States took action and brought an action against the state or the railroad company. Here, however, the 1856 and 64 Act, while it did describe the purpose was for constructing a right-of-way, this was a land grant. We have the benefit, Your Honors, of a rich body of Supreme Court decisions, which was not previously...
The decisions are all chaos. They don't add up. Inter-circuit conflicts. Not going to get anything out of the cases, I don't think.
With due respect, Judge Posner,
Don't argue the cases. See, they're in your briefs. You're not going to argue cases. So I don't understand you. You're arguing that the 1856 Act gave the odd lots to the railroad in fee simple, but then you're saying that if they don't build a railroad, they lose the land. Well, that sounds like a reversionary interest.
That was not a reversionary interest. The Supreme
what is
Court,
it?
Because
well, what's the difference?
The difference is this: once the right of way was actually constructed, the title became indefeasible and could no longer
be
taken
back.
What
if they built some little trolley line or something, and they ran it for a week, and then they, ripped it up?
Once the title was
perfected. Answer my question.
The answer is this: once the title.
The answer is either yes or no.
If it was a 20-mile stretch.
Don't say if.
Then the answer is they could not take it back.
Well, that's wrong. That's unreasonable. It creates all sorts of opportunities for fraud, right? You know, we'll build a little railroad, one wooden rail. Be actually a children's railroad. Then we'll run it for a week. Then we'll rip it up. Then we'll build condos.
In the 1800s, Congress was intent on making sure that these rails were constructed
and
across
the country.
Right, and
of course, the way you interpret it is fee simple with no reversionary interest. They don't accomplish that because they're faced with all these, fakes.
Your Honor, I would also refer you to the fact that in Congress knew how to create reversionary interest in rights of ways
and did so in other cases.
Okay.
Congress knew how. But there are always oversights in legislation, right? They're always forgetting how to do things. These statutes are very badly drafted. In fact, that's your whole argument for 912, right? I think plausibly, 912 is so badly drafted, it can't actually be interpreted literally, right?
I think that
912
is true
today. A mess. Maybe the 1856 statute is a mess.
The 1856 statute was clear. 912 for 66 years of the time in which it was applicable, between 1922 and 1988, 130,000 miles of rights of ways were abandoned across the country.
We don't know about each one of those rights of ways and how that all happened. I mean, I think you have a problem with 912, reading it as a whole. I'm not terribly persuaded that just because a lot of rails were abandoned, again, going back to the purpose of this, the whole purpose of giving the former ICC, now the Surface Transportation Board, the right to give permission for railroad abandonments comes from a mindset about railroad regulation that we just don't have anymore. the ICC didn't want people giving up railroads. They wanted to force railroads to continue to be in existence for much of the 20th century. Deregulation doesn't come along until the Carter administration and the Reagan administration and so on and so forth. So they write this statute to try to make it hard to abandon. And they then, if there's abandonment, there's a desire for some clarity in the decree of forfeiture or legislation.
They did make it hard for railroads to abandon it. And, in fact, Section 912 does require that use and occupancy shall cease before the rest of the section takes effect.
But once that happens, your system, you want there to be some complicated fact hearing to find out whether there's been abandonment in any given case, which seems to me the antithesis of something that a clear title system would adopt.
Our position is, Your Honor, that for 66 years these interests vested in the landowners, unless there had been some kind of a quiet title action finding to the contrary. For example, in the 1985 case Oregon Short Line, there was a quiet title action, and the court there determined that the right of way had not been abandoned, subject to an ICC abandonment authorization. But otherwise, we have 66 years of only six decisions even addressing Section 912. And so we look at Marshall, Keefe, and Harris.
Now, you have a good argument, which is that hundreds of, you know, there have been all these enormous abandonments, and there are no decrees or declarations of abandonment. It would be ridiculous to upset all these property rights. I understand that argument. But isn't your response to Judge Wood's question that the ICC permitted these abandonments?
The ICC,
right? Is that critical?
Well, it authorized them, but then I would say there was a two-step process. The authorization is certainly there in your case. You have our permission to abandon. But then the next question is, was the abandonment finally completed in a way that satisfied 912?
And the answer is yes, because
de facto, you obviously see abandonment. There are no rail tracks there anymore. There's somebody's garage. There are other things. But that may not be quite the same thing as 912.
Well, Congress knew in 1922, Congress knew that typically a quiet title action on railroad abandonments would proceed ex post facto. And that is what we are asserting here, Your Honors, is that this is what happened under 912 for 66 years. If it were necessary.
How's a title company supposed to search if 3 years later there's some quiet title action that someone loses?
Well,
you're assuming people win all quiet title actions, which is a nice assumption, but maybe not true.
Your Honor, 130,000 miles were abandoned. And we are not asserting.
How does a title company search if 3 years later there might be a quiet title action and the person loses?
Well, actually, that is also to our point, because a local quiet title action.
The title company just has to pay for insuring a bad title.
The insurance companies have warranted these titles, and what has happened
is,
they have
to pay if it turns out they're wrong.
Which is actually, and in this case, we have settled title for over a century. The title insurance companies have been warranting these titles, and now a century later.
That doesn't mean they're right. I mean, never mind.
912 has
your deeds were quit claims, right, for the properties that we're talking about.
Actually, for the property at issue in the even section, they were warranty deeds. In the odd section,
I'm talking the odd section.
In the odd section, it was a quit claim deed for the right of way, but the Forest Service asked the Johnsons to buy this right of way. The Johnsons bought it for $100,000, donated it to the Forest Service. 1982, the Forest Service says, we have reviewed title, and we would like for you now to pay taxes on the entire right-of-way for this entire property until the point of donation. The Forest Service thought that the Johnsons owned it at that point and asked the Johnsons to pay taxes for the entire right-of-way, which they donated to the Forest Service. The title has been settled for over a century, and only in this modern-day time are we rewriting what happened. The context is that these rights-of-ways were abandoned. We are not saying that there should have been hundreds of thousands of quiet title actions. We're saying just the opposite. The ICC authorized the abandonment. The railroads ceased to use this land. And what the 912 says is that when the use and occupancy ceases,
What you're saying is that when the ICC permits abandonment and then the railroad rips up the tracks, then everybody assumes, it's abandoned, right? I mean, that's what it amounts to.
In addition to that, the railroad has to give notice in the local county newspaper. So that's how the county gets notice.
Of course, they did give notice to Bayfield, which was going to condemn the stuff, right? It was going to condemn it. Didn't Bayfield negotiate? Was going to purchase the property?
The Bayfield was considering it.
Discovered this way it might get it free.
Yes, 30 years later.
Yeah.
With, of course, permission.
1980, right. It's 1980. That's the abandonment, right?
That is correct, at the latest.
In 1980, when it was abandoned, Bayfield thought it was abandoned and was thinking of buying it.
Yes.
Right. Now it discovers another method.
With the court's permission, I would like to reserve time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Ms. Fox. Ms. Fex, I'm sorry. Ms. Nieder?
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Barbara Nieder, and I represent Bayfield County. The case, I think it's important to put it in context, in the overall context of what the case is about. It's about federal land, public land.
But here's my problem. I want to go back to the 1852 Act. And my problem with your side of the case, and have issues with both sides, so it's certainly not limited to you. But my problem with your side is, even if you're willing to go the direction I was suggesting and say that there is more than one way that a second railroad might have satisfied the requirements of the 1852 Act, we start out with the St. Croix Railroad. Everybody agrees with that. And eventually it goes over to the North Wisconsin Railroad. But how it happens is important to me. It's in 1869, the state actually revokes the St. Croix's grant. And then 5 years go by when nothing is happening. And it's not until 1874 that the state enacts the legislation transferring this Bayfield branch to North Wisconsin. So 5 years is a long time. I mean, if it had been the next week, maybe you would have said it was all part of the same legislative package. But it's hard for me to look at that as anything but the erasure of whatever significant acts the St. Croix may have done, and you're just left with this company that was chartered in 1871, which is too late for the 1852 statute. So if you lose under the 1852 Act from the beginning, you only have this much weaker argument under the Land Grant Acts, the 56 and 64 statutes, that would support any concept that there was a federal easement or right of way or whatever you want to call the thing. And the reverter and no abandonment. There are a number of steps, but I want you to tell me why that gap didn't just knock your case out right at the beginning.
Well, there's a couple of different things going on there. First of all, the grant, the 1852 grant, is a federal grant.
I understand.
And
that.
It's a present grant, and under the terms.
But with conditions.
It had a number of conditions. Certainly. But once there's a railroad that's chartered, and once that map is filed, then it becomes a present absolute grant, in the words of the
Bolton case. So if 100 years later, some railroad starts up, if 100 years later, a railroad appears and it wants to build a right-of-way on these people's property, it can do so?
If the railroad was chartered and had those rights that continued.
1867, it's 100 years later. And the Northern Railway wasn't chartered then either.
Well, yes, that's correct. It was not. But I think it's important to look at what the Wisconsin.
For example, 100 years later, same, Wisconsin grant, it grants land to a new railroad. And is that new railroad then able to enforce
this? It was just chartered in 1990.
Right of way.
If that railroad filed a map over public land, if it could find public land now, that it could file a map over that charted a railroad, then I suppose it would be entitled to those rights.
Now, the public land was given to Wisconsin, and then it was sold.
But first of all, before that public land was given to Wisconsin, the 1852 Right-of-Way Act created a right-of-way over that land.
This long-defunct St. Croix Railroad created some perpetual right-of-way so that 100 years later a railroad can appear and say, well, we want that right-of-way because St. Croix had it.
Perpetual.
But that doesn't make any sense. The 1852 Act creates four conditions. The grantee railroad company has to be chartered within 10 years of the, you know, eventually 15 years of the passage of the Act. So we'll say 1868. The railroad company has to be authorized, construction has to begin, but when Wisconsin cancels the St. Croix's rights and somebody else comes along, whether it's 5 years later or 100 years later or whatever, and they haven't been chartered in time, it's hard for me to see how this initial condition, it's a condition precedent, if you will, it's not a condition subsequent, it's how that preserved the explicit reverter is very difficult for me to see.
Again, as you touched on earlier, even though that grant to the St. Croix was canceled by Wisconsin, it remains a federal grant, and there's a federal right-of-way out there that's been cleared.
There are four conditions that have to exist before a right-of-way arises, and if those conditions aren't met, then you don't even get to first base.
Well, I understand that, but I my position is that those conditions were met as to the St. Croix Railroad, and that grant was transferred to the...
There's a certain lack of common sense in your argument, because your argument says that because in 18... When was the St. Croix chartered?
The St. Croix was authorized in 1857 to build the line, and it was chartered in 1854.
Okay, because some utterly defunct railroad was given a grant of way 150 years ago, Bayfield County can come along and take these people's property for a snowmobile path. I mean, that's ridiculous. Right.
Well, I think it's important.
What does that do to security of property rights?
It's important to...
Someone builds a mansion, and all of a sudden, Bayfield comes along and says, actually, we're going to run a snowmobile path through your house. Very sorry, but look, St. Croix, they got that grant 150 years ago. Never expired.
It's important to recognize that the rights of the St. Croix were transferred to the North Wisconsin Railroad.
Not the rights of way.
Yeah, but let me explain.
The question, after that five-year gap, presumably the Wisconsin North Railroad gets something, but not that right of way. And look how they go about doing things. They have some federal properties that they have. They condemn some things. And, of course, if they own the fee simple absolute over property, they can do whatever they want to on it. They can build a railroad across it, or they can put up, you know, expensive hotels, or they can do anything else. They can farm it. So, as I say, I am just not at all convinced, given the timing of how things happened, that this initial right of the St. Croix survived the termination, the legislative termination of those rights by Wisconsin.
Well, and the resurrection of those rights by Wisconsin,
Wisconsin doesn't have the authority to change a federal statute. Wisconsin maybe
certainly not
resurrect them.
But if we look at what happened, that grant that was transferred to the North Wisconsin, the land grant, couldn't have come without the benefit of the right of way. Otherwise, you've got a situation where...
That's the 1856 Act argument.
You've got a situation where the North Wisconsin is given every alternate section of land.
I think your term resurrection is very apt.
Well, but those rights were transferred, and to the extent there was some corporate formality
why don't we move on and talk about 912, right?
Well, I do think, if I could just wrap up that thought, that the Schulenburg case makes it clear that if someone had the right to complain about whether the formalities of corporate succession under corporate law were met at the time it was the United States, certainly not these landowners.
There's no corporate succession here. It's completely separate companies.
So in terms of Section 912...
So what I don't understand about... I don't understand. Here we have the 130,000 abandoned railroad lines, and they're abandoned for many years, and there's all sorts of activities going on, private property and so on. And now the proposition is that somehow all of this can be converted to snowmobile paths? Is that your proposition? Because there are no decrees of abandonment, whatever a decree of abandonment is?
Well, we know what a decree of abandonment is because the Marshall Court did
it. What is a decree of abandonment?
It's when the court determines that the prerequisites for...
Is there such a legal animal called a decree of abandonment?
As I mentioned, in the Marshall case, there was a decree of abandonment issued. The court said it is hereby decreed, pursuant to Section 912, that this such and such right-of-way is abandoned.
Every time one of these 100, I don't know how many abandonments there are in 130,000 miles, I'm sure a lot, they're mostly branch lines, so probably say there are 10,000 abandonments. So every time there's an abandonment, the railroad, it's not enough to get permission of the ICC, it's not enough to rip up the rail lines. They have to go into some court, I don't know, local, federal, go into a court and ask for a decree of abandonment? Is that what you're saying?
Well, first of all, the 133,000 miles, who knows whether those were federally granted rights of way or not? It was a statement in an amicus brief. There's nothing in the record.
All right. Well, how many abandonments have there been?
I have no idea. As I say, there's
nothing in the record to tell us the answer to that. You should know.
But
why
in terms
you know?
Of...
Maybe the government's lawyer will know.
In terms of whether this decree
I've
is necessary...
I've never seen a decree of abandonment.
Well, I only know of the one that's been issued.
Have you ever seen a decree of abandonment?
I've seen the case reporting.
But you've never actually seen a decree of abandonment?
Only in the form of a judicial decision, which
you've
I take...
You've seen a judicial decision that discussed a decree of abandonment. You have never seen a decree of abandonment.
Well, I took the decree to be the decision, or the decision to be the decree. That's what it would be. A court of competent jurisdiction making a declaration. I hereby declare that this abandonment has occurred.
So apparently for the last, since 1922, maybe there's one decree, but apparently there have been maybe 10,000 abandonments, and they've all been accepted as valid, and yet there haven't been any decrees of abandonment.
Somebody has to ask. Somebody needs to ask.
Are you saying, using the resurrection language, that all the local municipalities and, Bayfield County and the rest, they can just say, oh, by the way, we're going to run a snowmobile path through your property.
So
that's
me,
the scheme that's been established by Congress.
Let me phrase this maybe in a somewhat different way. I mean, if you listened to Ms. Fex, I mean, she was essentially saying that the presumption under the 912 Act is that after the ICC has given permission to abandon and acts consistent with that have taken place, there's abandonment. And somebody who wants to rebut that presumption would have to bring some kind of action to upset it. Now, you're saying the opposite. You're saying nothing has been abandoned until somebody has said so. So you've reversed the presumption, essentially. And the question is, under this statute, who's right, really? I mean, what should we make of this statute?
There is no presumption in Section 912. That what it says is
nothing is abandoned until there's an affirmative statement. She's saying anything is abandoned until there's a statement that says no.
I'm saying that under the way the statute has been set up, certainly physical abandonment can occur, and the ICC can authorize that abandonment can occur. But that doesn't do anything with respect to the property rights. That's where the decree
is
or declaration is needed.
90 years of practice, right?
Not necessarily.
Unbroken practice.
Not necessarily.
You have no knowledge about this at all. Are you going to say that, no, there have been thousands of rescinded abandonments, because of resurrection of old rights? Is that what you're going to argue to me?
What does the practice tell us? All it tells us is that people didn't go into court.
What the practice tells us is that when, for almost a century, thousands of people behave in a consistent way that departs from the literal terms of the statute, nevertheless, this is highly relevant in interpreting the statute, right? Do you have congressmen saying, what's going on here, all these abandonments without decrees? Right? They don't have anything like that.
But what we have is Congress saying in 1922, you have to have a decree. Otherwise, we won't know what the trigger point is for these other rights to vest.
We don't know what they mean. What they might mean is simply that, following on what Judge Wood was saying, of course, if someone challenges this, says it's not an abandonment, yeah, you're going to have a judicial determination, that's for sure. But if no one challenges it, because it's been permitted and it's been ripped up, and if no one challenges it, then apparently for 90 years, it's just been accepted. Yeah, it's abandoned.
But that doesn't change the law. That doesn't change congressional intent to preserve these trails.
You're throwing many thousands of titles into doubt by your position.
If I may
respond, Bayfield County snowmobile paths.
If I may respond, I see my time is up, but may I respond to the question about titles? The thought of throwing titles into question really is a false problem that I think it is, because that assumes a level of certainty with respect to railroad titles and rights of way that just isn't there. Nothing appears in these chains of titles as a result of these assumptions.
You can't just say that, because we don't know what kind of land uses are made on these abandoned rail lines. For all we know, the title companies and the title registries and buyers and sellers figure if a railroad was abandoned and was ripped up and was abandoned with the permission of the ICC, there are no encumbrances on that land, and you can build a house on it, and you don't have to worry about the snowmobile path coming. Now, maybe the practice is different, and everybody's afraid to build on it, but you don't have any evidence of that.
I do. The S.C. Johnsons here, they claim that they got the land that comprises the right-of-way over their section by operation of state law or under Section 912 automatically. Where does it say that in their chain of title? Why is that chain of title disrupted for something that doesn't even appear in the chain of title? That's what we're talking about. We're talking about what people assumed,
but
not what showed up in their chain of
titles,
title by operation of law that was never recorded.
The problem with operating on the titles is, by the same token, no one seems to have thought to record the right of reverter of the United States on the deeds that were given from the mid-19th century forward, whatever you want to call it, a limited fee, or whether you want to call it functionally an easement, or whatever label in property law you want to put on it, it's not noted there. So people looking at their title could be forgiven for thinking that they really do have the full title.
Certainly could be forgiven for that, but if you go back to the case law, the Townsend case, the Baldwin case, any number of cases make it clear that when those patents are given, they're given subject to the right-of-way, and that people were put on notice that where there's a railroad, you take the land subject to that right-of-way, even if it doesn't appear in the patent.
And what if
so
there's
the
no
land
railroad?
Titles are
what
a mess.
What if they ripped up these tracks here in northern Wisconsin, and let's just assume, I don't remember when this happened, but let's assume for the sake of argument it happened in 1970, and three sales later down the line, somebody, the S.C. Johnson Trust wants to sell their land to someone, this litigation to one side, and so somebody walks around the land. They don't see any sign of a railroad anywhere. They think it's just a land, and it's a warranty deed.
Well, but then they go back into the chain of title.
People are supposed to go read the U.S. report.
But then they go back into the chain of title and they see that there's been a series of quitclaim deeds along the way. Sometimes the railroad right-of-way has been conveyed, sometimes it hasn't.
Actually, they said it was warranty deeds on the even-numbered lots.
Well, as to the even-numbered section, the very first deed, once Amos Jefferson got that land, the very first thing he did was quitclaim it.
What's the practice of the title insurance companies? The title insurance companies refused to insure these titles, the Johnson title?
There's no evidence in the record as to whether they do or they don't.
Well, maybe you should have produced some evidence.
I can't answer that question.
Okay, well, thank you, Ms. Niner.
Thank
you. Ms. Tardif?
Good morning, Your Honors. Chris Tardif for the United States. Let me try and address a couple of questions that have come up in the course.
What is the interest of the United States?
The interest of the United States is that when the right-of-way was granted across these lands, which were public lands at the time, the United States retained a reversionary interest.
Well, it hasn't been public land for quite a while, so what's your current interest?
Well, there was a disclaimer of interest filed previously in this litigation, but that does not affect the original reversionary interest retained.
I don't understand you.
We have.
If you have no interest, if you disclaimed an interest, why are you here?
Our interest, Your Honor, is in the correct interpretation of these federal laws.
That's ridiculous. There has to be some concrete interest of the federal government.
We certainly have an interest in the interpretation of.
No,
of
you don't. What is your interest?
Our interest is in.
It must have to do with the use of this land. You must be promoting snowmobiling or something, right?
In enacting Section 912, Congress was very clear that in disposing of these right-of-ways...
I don't know what the interest of the Department of the Interior is.
The interest of the United States as a whole, including Department of the Interior, is that these publicly created rights-of-way, Congress intended that they be allowed to continue in that public use and be used for public highways, and only if that use was not...
What is the public use you want to put these hundreds of thousands of miles of abandoned lines to?
These rights-of-way, both here and throughout the country, were created to create a national transportation network, and the interest of the government is in allowing that public use to continue.
That, of course, is totally obsolete. I don't know why you don't answer my question.
I'm
asking for a practical interest of the government in appearing in this case. And don't tell me you're interested in enforcement of federal law. You must have some practical...
We are interested in making sure that these publicly created rights of way...
You must have an interest in what is going to happen to all these abandonments which you want to recapture for...
I think it's clear from the
uses.
From the 1988 statute that's in the record, 16 U.S.
Answer my question.
I'm trying to answer your question.
I want to know concretely, what is the administration's interest in upsetting these titles in order to bring these abandoned railroad lines under, I guess, mostly local government control?
We are not seeking...
I'm criticizing. I'm just curious. Is this an environmental thing or what?
It is not. We are not seeking to upset title because there was no title conveyed to the abutting landowners in these right-of-way lands.
That's fencing. This land at present, all this abandoned stuff, is owned by private people and used for their private purposes. And you want to bring a lot of this stuff back into the public sphere for availability for bicycling, snow, other nature uses. I'm just wondering if this is some environmental project. What exactly is your reason for wanting to be a participant in this litigation?
It is not, Your Honor. Your question presumes that title to these rights-of-way lands has transferred into private interest. It has not.
You are not listening to me. I'm not talking legalisms.
Okay.
I am asking what is the administration's concern, its program, for this abandoned stuff. And is this environmental or what? I'm just curious.
There are actually a number of different programs, so that's not an easy question to answer. But generally speaking, where there were publicly created rights of way, so federally granted rights of way, there are a number of programs by which Congress intended that these right-of-ways be made available for other public uses, whether it's public highway uses, which was the case with Section 912. In 1988, Congress changed 912 and said, okay, we're no longer going to allow, if these rights-of-way are not taken up and used for other public highway purposes, we're no longer going to allow the conveyance of them to abutting landowners. They are going to come back to the United States, and then the United States will make a determination as to the further public use.
So if snowmobiling falls out of favor, this property reverts to the U.S.? If it's not used for that anymore or some other pathway?
Once, under Section 912, which is the statute that applies here at this for this particular case, if the county or another government entity comes in and within that one-year trigger period and says, we want to use this for public highway purposes, the federal grant effectively is transferred to the county. If the county at that point elects down the road not to use that grant anymore, I think at that point under 912, it would then convey to the abutting landowners. But only at that point. The abutting landowners do not have a private property interest in these rights-of-way lands unless and until
all these
first other events.
How does it happen that it then goes to the abutting landowners? How does that happen?
I think by operation of Section 912 it would occur. And I don't know that we've had that particular situation.
Not with a separate decree.
Excuse me?
Just by operation of law, not with some separate decree from a court.
That's a good question. And again, I don't know that we've had that particular fact situation come up. But I think once the right-of-way is conveyed as for public highway purposes to, in this case, the county under Section 912, where that will occur, if the county thereafter decides to abandon, well, there may have to be a subsequent decree for that as well. That's a good question. I don't know that I know the precise answer to that standing before you.
You're saying the United States just wants it because it's theirs, and they, you know, and so whether they build a public highway across this right-of-way, which I gather is wide enough that one could conceivably do that, or whether they build a bike trail, or whether they build, you know, a snowmobile path, or whether they just put fences up to keep everybody out, that's all up to the United States.
The grant to other government entities, be they state, county, local governments, is for public highway purposes. The case law suggests that Congress has left to the states to define what a public highway
is. Where is the right-of-way described? Its path and its width and so on.
In this particular case, in two locations. In the 1856 Act, the endpoints of the line were defined, and then there was a map of location that was filed in 1858 that defined the general route. And then, of course, the line was actually
was not
constructed.
Accurate, right? The map.
That map was not accurate. And let me say, on the issue of deviations, that was not unusual. I mean, survey techniques were fairly rudimentary at this point in time. Deviations, I dare say, were the norm, not the exception.
Right, and they ran into problems building, I assume, so they went around.
Absolutely correct. And we have an 1887 decision of the Secretary of Interior in the record dealing with these exact deviations and saying that those deviations didn't upset the grant of the right of way.
Back to Judge Poster's question, where is the description of
I think there's two places. I mean, there's the original map, but then you have the as-constructed line. And once the line was constructed, it was present on the landscape.
So is that reflected, though, in the Secretary of the Interior publication?
I think in that 1887 it's certainly reflected. I don't know that in this record there were maps of the line as constructed that were included, but that was actually a pretty typical practice. But the important point is that once the requirements of the 1852 Act were met, and Judge Wood, you noted four requirements, as we view it, for the grant to take effect, there were two requirements. There was you needed the charter from the state, you needed to submit your map. And once those two events occurred, the grant of the right-of-way lands became effective. The timing issues with respect to construction are really conditions subsequent. And if a railroad failed to construct, the United States could certainly come back in and seek a forfeiture.
But it's your view that that's where the United States was the only one to complain.
Absolutely correct, Your Honor.
So this could, in fact, in Judge Posner's earlier hypothetical, have dragged on for 100 years, and if the United States was happy to sit on its hands, then private parties were taking these lands at their peril.
I think as the government's involvement with the grant of right-of-ways evolved over time, and 1852 was pretty early in that process, in subsequent statutes you see, for example, the United States imposing both time limits on construction and specifically dealing with forfeiture, saying, you know, 5 years after, as you'll see in the 1875
Act. So that might be true for some or all of this other alleged 130,000 miles. I mean, it may not all be under this 1852 vague, unclear statute.
Our view, based on the facts here, is that the right-of-way in question, the likely source of the right-of-way grant is 1852.
If you say that there are 130,000 such miles of this in the country, some of them may have been under a different legal regime and therefore a more clear legal regime.
Absolutely. I think what we see...
No.
As to the specific number of right-of-ways, no. And I think that figure...
Do you know anything about these 130,000 miles?
I know some. I know that figure was a nationwide figure in terms of it's extrapolated from information in the Purcell versus ICC Supreme Court decision. That figure was a total figure and did not just include federally granted right-of-ways, which...
How many miles of federal right-of-way?
I don't have a specific figure on that, and I think in the absence of that figure, though, I will say that there were a series of federal railroad land grants, and they are different. The terms are different and change over time. And Congress, in fact, I think got a little better as they enacted these statutes over
years. Is there a concept of laches here that would limit the government's ability to... snatch back, to resurrect public rights after hundreds of years?
There is not, because it is not a snatching back, because the interest in the right-of-way lands was never conveyed to the abutting landowners. Excuse me?
The use of laches to limit take-backs.
Not in this case, because there was no conveyance to the landowners to begin with.
There was no conveyance to the landowners?
There was no transfer of the lands within the right-of-way to these landowners.
Well, they obviously thought they were getting it. That's why the question whether laches is available.
But you
someone,
don't...
Someone named the United States sits on its rights for ages.
But you're on a property interest in the United...
Bayfield, right? Bayfield, 1980, knew everything was abandoned. Shouldn't there be some... doctrine of laches applicable at least to Bayfield, if not to the United States?
No, they opted not to purchase the right-of-way at that time, but then Section 912 provides, you know, a one-year period. To trigger that period, somebody's got to come into court and get that decree, and to the extent that the landowners were seeking...
Really, you also share this view of Ms. Nider that abandonments are ineffectual if there is not a contemporaneous decree of a court? Have you ever seen a decree of abandonment?
I think, like Ms. Nider, I've seen the reference to it in Marshall. Let me explain why you don't see more of those. We have Section 912, which was enacted to deal with the disposition of these rights of way. In 1988, again, Congress changed that and said, well, we're no longer going to transfer these rights of way to abutting landowners if there's no public highway need. We're going to retain these. So after 1988, you're not going to see, for instance, a landowner coming in and seeking that decree to trigger the one-year period and try and get the property rights, because they can't do so after 1988. So the window where you see active abandonments by the railroad or rail lines under the ICC process and the overlap of 912 is actually much smaller than would otherwise appear. So there have not been a lot of those instances that we're aware of. But suffice it to say that during the time period where Section 912 applies, if a landowner was seeking to acquire lands within a right-of-way where a railroad had pulled up its tracks, all it had to do was go into court and get that decree. That triggered the one-year period.
Go in and get that decree, but I've never heard of a decree of abandonment.
It's a feature enacted by Congress as part of this act. And if you look at the legislative history, Congress added it to make sure landowners weren't controlling the process.
I think this is too hard. I mean, your position is that when somebody became aware that there was a railroad at one point across the land, they should go to court and file a quiet title action. If the court quieted title and said the federal government no longer has right-of-way interests, then that's it. I mean, that doesn't have to have decree of abandonment across the town.
There has to be sufficient language in a court order. I think it could.
Titles, decree, that's what they're for, actually,
right.
To resolve leftover potential land interests.
I think that's right. And as long as you have, you know, a sufficient court decree, whatever form it takes to put everyone on notice that this one-year period has been triggered, that's really all the statutes require.
So why is it that the practice was not to quiet title, but simply to treat the permission of the ICC followed by the actual destruction of the rail lines as abandonment?
Well, I don't know that that's actually the practice. I mean, as we view it, the ICC process, all that does was granted authorization to abandon service on the line.
Well, that was
that's
the practice, because there have been many abandonments, and there haven't been any decrees except in that one case.
Well, and again, Your Honor, not all of those abandonments involve federally
that's
granted
true,
rights of way.
That's true, but many of them did, right?
Many of them did.
Extensive federal railroad rights of way.
Some of them did, and some of those have been picked up through the Rails to Trails program, which is yet another mechanism for preserving these rights of way.
But the practice was not to bother to quiet title, right?
And that's
Do
a decision.
Do we know that, or has anybody studied state law? I mean, this would all be a matter of state law.
In the case of privately granted rights of way, it's a question of state law. In the matter of federally granted rights of way, it's a matter of federal law.
I'm imagining the quiet title action could be. Do you think they all had to be in federal court?
The statute says court of competent jurisdiction. I think to the extent we're dealing with questions of federal law, federal court would be the more appropriate place for those decisions to be.
Well, then surely if these were common, we would know about them, right?
There are not many of them, and I don't have a clear explanation as to why that is. It may be that railroads chose not to. Landowners can chose
not to. Title insurance companies apparently weren't troubled.
They weren't troubled enough to file that, correct. I mean, and my understanding, and we, again, there's no title insurance records in here, but I've been dealing with these issues for years, and generally title companies have exceptions for rights of way, of record or not, and that's how they deal with it and protect their interest in these matters.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Ms. Cardiff.
Thank you very much.
So the plaintiffs, do you have any more? Mr. Stewart or Ms. Fex?
Thank you. There are a few points that I want to address. First of all, Ms. Tardif just indicated that there were no decisions after 1988 on 912. Well, in fact, the Marshall, Keefe, and Harris cases were all taking place after 1988, and in each of those cases, there was an ex post facto decree of abandonment. The Holmgren decision we do have. We have the Holmgren decision on this very right-of-way, which indicated that right-of-way was abandoned back in 1978.
Not your portion, of course, a different portion.
Not our portion. But in terms of 912, as hard as it is to parse, I mean, the 912 refers to a decree concerning a, quote, right-of-way, not for every property owner along the line. And again, to require every property owner along the line to bring in their own quiet title action would have resulted in hundreds of thousands of quiet title
maybe
actions.
Maybe it would, but I'm remembering that we had a case out of Indiana dealing with similar rights of way where a telecommunications company wanted to lay fiber optic cable along the right of way. And in fact, the decision there was that each landowner did have to, I mean, their questions did have to be brought as a class action, you know, were there common questions? And so it's not quite the same issue as yours, but it's not so far from yours either. So it's conceivable every landowner does have to do something.
Well, in terms of the class action, both the Schmidt and the Moore decisions did indicate that having a class action was desirable to avoid the individual quiet title actions in order to bring
a. But that's just a way of handling a lot of individual actions collectively. It doesn't mean there aren't individual actions.
Certainly, but that is, frankly, where there is a mechanism to do so. To bring a class action, to bring quiet title, would be to try to basically overcome extraordinary obstacles.
I don't see
in
why.
Order to.
If there's a common question about whether the railroad abandoned, you've just been standing here saying that this one little section shows that it was abandoned throughout, and well may have been. You know, if abandonment is a common issue. So, in fact,
we know that the railroad would have indicated that it was abandoning the entire line in the county newspaper. There
so
would have
our,
been
our Mahler case is out the window if we are to come out your way, right?
The Mahler case still did indicate that even if there were, even if 912 did not apply, that it was still worked under 43 U.S.C. 913. The construing 912 was not in dispute in the Maller case. And so really the only issue in Maller was whether there were federal, whether the land grant was reversionary or not. But the plaintiffs, the appellants in that case, did not contest the application of 912 as applying post, ex post facto. The other point that, that's important to make for your honors is that on the issue of the deviation in the even sections, that land decision was about place lands, and that's an extraordinarily important distinction between place lands and a right-of-way grant when it comes to a deviation. The case North Pacific versus Smith, the 1898 case that we cited, stands for the proposition, U.S. Supreme Court case, if there's a deviation in a right-of-way that is different from a deviation in a land grant, and the deviation is material in terms of who got the rights on that particular public land. So with a deviation, if the landowner gets there first, it's the landowner, not the railroad. Important distinction, and for that reason, that land decision is not applicable in terms of the even sections. And the last point that I want to make is that LEO SHEEP stands for the important proposition that, that title that has vested over a century should not be disturbed unless there is a good reason for it. The United States in the 1900s consistently, starting in 1942, if not earlier, disavowed an interest in retaining these reversionary interests. In the 1970s, we have the EATSE cases. We have the Secretary Andrews standing up in front of the Tenth Circuit arguing that it didn't, that the United States did not retain these reversionary interests when passing the serving estate to the landowners unless there were mineral rights. Only today, after 1988 and this recreational trail statute came along, does the United States come in here and make this argument to the court. And for that reason, Your Honors, we would respectfully request that you reverse the decision below and find in favor of our clients.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Fex. Mr. Stewart, do you have anything further? Okay, well, thank you very much to both.